sat the unmistakable cracker bulk of Charlie Croker. With a heave of his chest, Croker rose and came walking, or rather limping, toward him. He seemed so much older than his pictures, and wearier. He gave Roger a smile, but it was a tired smile, and he had circles under his eyes. Yet he radiated physical power. He had on a white shirt and a dark red necktie, but no jacket. His neck, trapezius muscles, shoulders, and chest seemed to be a single unit welded mass. They were so big, it was as if he were wearing a chest protector beneath his shirt. His hands were so big, Roger braced as they shook hands for fear he might be another hearty bone crusher like Buck McNutter. Roger's hands disappeared inside this huge white man's, just as had been the case when he met McNutter. But in fact, there was nothing unusual about the pressure Croker exerted. Croker indicated that they should go to an alcove that opened off the big room and sit in a pair of low but plush leather swivel chairs. There were floor-to-ceiling windows. Down below, in the foreground, was a rolling thicket of green treetops that ran together so densely there was no sign whatsoever of the earth below, let alone the houses and roadways. The expanse of greenery was so vast and lush, it made you blink. "Spectacular view," said Roger. Croker turned his head and looked at it himself for a moment, then turned back to Roger and said wearily, "Yeah, I reckon it is. Trouble with views is, after the first couple of weeks, they don't surprise you any more." Roger didn't know what to say to that, and so Croker continued. "I'd like to write a history of views, if I could write, which I can't. If you look at Atlanta real estate long enough, you'll notice there was a time not all that long ago when folks didn't care about views one way or the other. Views came cheap as the air and a lot cheaper than dirt. Then, long about the 1960s, I reckon it was, folks discovered views, and that gave everybody one more thing to get competitive about." The man sounded like the old philosopher, wiser but wearier, a note Roger found disarming. Croker sighed and said, "So, you and Zandy White are partners. I mean, Scott." He shook his head and cast his eyes down and said, "Nothing wrong with me. God almighty. Scott, Scott, Scott." Roger tried to analyze that one. Was it a simple transposition, his name for Zandy's? Or was it a Freudian slip that said, "He, Zandy, is white, but you're not"? By now Croker had started over. "Okay, as I thought I was saying, so you and Zandy Scott are partners." "Well, yes," said Roger, smiling to show he didn't care about the slip. "We're partners, although some partners are more equal than others. I don't know whether you know Zandy or not. I haven't mentioned to him that I was coming to see you." This was by way of notifying Croker that this was something Zandy Scott didn't know about and didn't have to know about. That, in turn, made him wonder what was on Croker's mind at this moment. To tell the truth, Charlie was thinking about the fact that this black man, whose name, like an idiot, he had just pinned on a white man, had no black accent at all. He had begun to run across that more and more, especially since the Clarence Thomas Supreme Court hearings on television, when there you had one black person after another, professional people, and if you closed your eyes you couldn't tell if they were black or white. "Well," Croker said, "what can I do for you?" He said it with such a tired smile that Roger felt as if he was talking to someone who had come out on the losing end of a very long war. "Mr. Croker," he said, realizing as soon as the words left his mouth that the little speech he had rehearsed was going to come out sounding stilted, "I represent a young athlete at Georgia Tech, a football player named Farik Fannin." "So I gather," said Croker. "I read about it in the paper this morning." He looked at Roger with a level and slightly suspicious gaze. Then he yawned and quickly covered his mouth with his hand. Roger was startled, taken aback, since he didn't realize that this was a sign not of boredom but of advanced insomnia. "I assure you," Roger said, "that everything I've tried to do for my client thus far has been with an eye toward avoiding this kind of publicity. But that battle I've already lost." He sounded terribly pompous to himself. "So now my main objective is to try to keep this thing from turning into a racial battleground." Charlie was busy trying to calculate where all this was leading. He decided that this solemn, somewhat stiff, educated black man was now going to ask him to intercede with Inman. The only interesting part would be listening to him trying to articulate the reasons why. Lawyer White was sitting quite upright in the leather swivel chair. He had begun massaging the knuckles of his left hand with the fingers of his right hand. Nerves. Trying to figure out just how to put it, no doubt. Bathed in the light that came flooding in through the window wall, he didn't look very dark at all. Almost pale, in fact. "As you know," said Roger, "Farik Fannin is an All-American running back, probably the most famous Georgia Tech running back since one named Charles Croker." Just as he had rehearsed it, he paused and smiled warmly. To his dismay, Croker yawned again and covered his mouth. He could think of nothing else to do but plow on. "So I'm sure you're aware, probably more aware than anyone else I can think of the pressures that suddenly converge on a young man when he has achieved fame of that magnitude, pressures of every sort, social pressures, public pressures, personal pressures, so that all at once you're vulnerable to forces you've never even thought about before, forces you were never even aware of." He paused and looked at Croker, hoping to coax at least a nod of agreement out of him concerning that broad, general principle. All he saw was the big white man's mouth and mandibles twisting and struggling mightily to avoid another yawn. So he put the question squarely. "Do you agree? Is that true, generally speaking?"
"Oh, I reckon," said Croker.
Then he lifted his hands from his lap and gave them a little ironic toss in the air and said,
"And therefore?"
"Is he mocking me?" Roger wondered. Aloud, somewhat flustered, "Well, the thing is, we'd like for you to meet Farik. Spend a little time with him if you can. See what he's like. See if you agree with us. See if you think he's the kind of young man who would do what all these rumors and anonymous reports accuse him of doing." Croker sighed, leaned back in his chair, and put on a big smile that was without any doubt ironic and disconcerting. And then he said,
"Who's we?"
Roger said, "Well, Farik and a great many backers of the Tech Athletic Program and a great many people who look upon Farik as a role model. This thing could turn into a very ugly situation, even if, by the usual standards, the charges prove to have no basis in fact, which in fact is the case." He was aware of tripping on his own verbal vines and thickets. Croker gave his smile a twist to one side. Definitely ironic.
"So, we want me to spend some time with Farik Fannin."
Roger's heartbeat quickened. This was going to be the tricky part to put into words. "We realize that, this would be an imposition on you. It would be an imposition on anybody, but especially you, since we realize that you, have far more urgent problems right now than the fate of Farik Fannin. But we think we're in a position to clear the deck of those problems, so to speak, so that you will have the time to, devote some time to what we hope you'll be able to do." He paused again, desperately hoping Croker would at least come out and meet him halfway on this misty terrain he had just sketched in. Croker cocked his head to one side and said,
"What urgent problems are you talking about?"
"May I speak frankly?"
"Sure. Go ahead."
"We're very much aware of the fix you're in with Planners Bank. We're aware of what happened with your Gulfstream V aircraft and other measures the bank is threatening to take." Croker still had his head cocked to one side. "Well, the fact is, if I can figure out the most exact way to put this, the fact is that Farik, as an Atlanta celebrity with a big following, if you will, and various backers of Tech's athletic program have enough friends so as to be able to convince Planner's Bank that it's, how the hell did this part go? He'd gone over it 100 times in his mind. That it's in their interest, as a big part of the city themselves, in their long-term interest, and possibly their short-term interest even, since this thing has the potential to rip apart the entire fabric of the Atlanta way in race relations, it's in their interest to put your financial troubles behind you, and behind them, for good, so that you can devote your time and your interests to the role that you can now play in this crisis, or what could easily develop into a crisis, for the entire city. He was aware of the sweat that had begun to flow in his armpits, beneath his T-shirt, the striped body of his shirt, and his 12-ounce navy worsted suit with its fashionably high-cut armholes.
"Put them behind me. How?" said Croker.
He still had his head cocked to one side, but he wasn't giving him the ironic smile any more. Perhaps he had taken a few baby steps out into the mist. "Completely restructure the loans," said Roger, "and call off the bank's workout department." Croker said,
"All this in return for my spending some time with Farik Fannin."
"And an expression of your sympathy and support for Farik as someone who's been in precisely the same situation himself, at the same college, someone who was once a young man with the same pressures and vulnerabilities. I mean, if you genuinely feel that way after getting to know Farik. I realize that's a big if."
"And just how would I go about expressing my sympathy and support?"
"A press conference."
"A press conference?"
"Yes."
"And then my troubles will disappear."
"Well, obviously it can't be as simple as that," said Roger, "since what actually hangs in the balance here is the concern of many important players in the civic life of the city, their desire to defuse what could develop into a very ugly situation for them and the Atlanta Way and, well, the whole city. But, in a word, to answer your question, yes."
"So what would I do?"
said Croker, leaning forward in his seat and lowering his head slightly.
"Just take your word for it that you can deliver on such a promise?"
"I know what you're saying," said Roger, "and I don't blame you." All the while thinking, "Oh yes, he's definitely out on that misty terrain now." "There'll be a very simple test. Once you've met with Farik, you decide whether or not to go ahead with the press conference. If you say yes, then you let us know, and immediately all pressure from Planner's Bank will cease. If you then do your part at the press conference, it will cease for good, and the bank will restructure the loans on the most generous terms imaginable. If you say no..." Roger drew in his chin and pulled a face that as much as said, "They'll sick the dogs back on you." Croker put his tongue in his cheek and just stared at him for what seemed like an eternity. Then he said,
"If I'm hearing what I think I'm hearing, then this is the goddamnedest proposition I ever heard of."
"Well," said Roger, "this is an unusual situation, and it could become a critical situation in the life of this city, especially if the identity of the young woman in this situation becomes known. And a lot of people know it already. Do you know who it is?" Croker hesitated. Then he said,
"Yes, I do."
Roger said, A lot of people in a position to try to head it off, they see this as a situation like the Rodney King case, or even the death of Martin Luther King, a situation where the city becomes polarized. Atlanta's claim is, we're the city that has put all that behind us. So if this city lets itself get polarized again, the implications, including the economic implications, there'd be just no end to it. so people are willing to go to great lengths to try to head such a situation off.
Okay, said Croker. Let's say that's so.
No more mocking smile.
How do you, we, they, whoever you're talking about here, how do you expect to put that kind of pressure on Planners Bank?
Roger said, That I'm not at liberty to go into. That's why we're proposing a test. We can either deliver or we can't.
Croker crossed his arms over his chest and put on the sort of ironic smile that says, This is all pretty far-fetched, but since we're playing this little game of make-believe, let's play it out to the end.
Aloud, he said,
Okay, let's suppose that you manage to call off the dogs, and then I go see Farik Fannin and come away telling everybody what a great human being he is. How am I supposed to be sure Planners Bank won't turn right around and come after me again?
Then you'd disavow your support for Farik.
On what ground? That some very nice young man came by one day,
Croker gestured toward Roger,
representing Farik Fannin, and he told me he'd take care of everything if I said something nice about his client.
Whatever, said Roger. Anything you said at that point would make it look bad for us. We'd have the same sort of recourse. If you reneged on your support for Farik, the bank would be turned loose on you again.
Look, Mr. Croker, even in the most tightly drawn contract, there's always the risk of one party committing an act of betrayal that makes the contract meaningless. That's one of the first things we were taught at the UGA Law School. All agreements are founded on the proposition that, at the end of the day, it doesn't pay to be known as someone who is utterly perfidious.
At the end of the day, thought Charlie, even this black lawyer from UGA was lapsing into whiz-speak. Already his mind was churning. Was it even remotely possible that he could do what he claimed he could do? Who would have that kind of leverage with Planners Bank? Certainly not him. And not even Ringer, Fleecem & Tick, which was nothing but a high-class valet service for corporate Atlanta. His contempt for lawyers, people who made their living speaking out of any side of their mouths you paid them to speak out of, was profound. Assuming it wasn't all bullshit, who was he talking about? It had to be Georgia Tech itself. The Institute's leverage in Atlanta, if they really wanted to exert it, was incalculable. But why would they choose a relatively young black lawyer to rally the troops? That would make no sense. Or was there something about racial PR that he, Charlie, didn't comprehend? And was Fannin so important to them that they could just hang Inman and his daughter out to dry? Did it really get back to what Billy Bass had told him that night at Turpentine? Namely, that Farik Fannin was the cover boy for the Institute's entire capital fundraising campaign, and that money talks and bullshit walks. Money talks and bullshit walks. Ruefully, he realized that he had picked up that little expression from that character with the big melon chin, Zale, at the Planners Bank workout session. And what if he did endorse Farik Fannin? How could he ever look Inman in the face again? Twice he had offered Inman his support. Offered it. Once that night at the driving club, and again yesterday morning. No, he could never turn his back on Inman. But still, think of the miracle that was being dangled before him, the obliteration of his entire mountain of debt. As if reading his mind, the black lawyer said,
I can't stress it too strongly, Mr. Croker. The crux of the matter is that this thing involves far more than any one person's reputation. More than Farik Fannin's, just to start with my client. You would be rendering a public service by expressing sympathy for Farik, even if you didn't mean it. Even if it turns out you don't like him. Which I hope won't be the way it'll turn out. To have someone like yourself in his corner would diffuse the whole situation, keep it from turning into an outright black versus white issue. We're not talking about any legal process here. We're talking about the mental atmosphere of an entire city.
But why me? Said Charlie.
I'm not going to try to pussyfoot around the subject, Mr. Croker. You're in a unique position. You're the Farik Fannin of another period, a star running back for Georgia Tech, and in some ways an even bigger star, since you also starred on defense. And you were known as the 60-minute man and everything. Even though it was coming from a black mouthpiece, a special pleader, Charlie liked this warm breeze wafting by his ears. And you're a member of the white establishment in this city. You're a member of the Piedmont Driving Club and everything else that's worth belonging to. You're not some push-button liberal. You're uniquely qualified to do what has to be done. In spite of himself, Charlie could feel himself weakening, feel himself trying to believe all this errant flattery pouring out of this slick black lawyer. So he fought back. His sense of loyalty, his sense of honor, his strength of character in the face of temptation, well, not counting sexual temptation, which a man really had no rational control over, his personal courage, which had never deserted him, not even in the deadliest moments on the field of battle in Vietnam. All of this would make him do the right thing, and— But, of course, at the same time, it wouldn't hurt, would it, as a matter of curiosity, as a sheer experiment, to see if this lawyer, dressed up like a British diplomat, actually could control the workout department at Planner's Bank with a mere snap of his fingers, implausible as that sounded. It wouldn't hurt to see if such a stunt could be pulled, would it? Wouldn't compromise him in any way? Wouldn't force him to support Farik the Cannon Fannin if he didn't want to? Wouldn't even force him to lay eyes on the man. And so, before he knew it, he heard himself saying, "All right, if you want my honest opinion, not you, and not Farik Fannin, and not anybody who knows Farik Fannin, and not all of Georgia Tech and all of Georgia Tech's friends working together, can pull off what you say you can pull off. But maybe I'll give you a chance to prove me wrong." He smiled his biggest, broadest, most insinuating smile, to indicate that this was merely a little game he was interested in. "I'll go see Mr. Fannin, and then I'll let you know what I think. Fair enough?"
"Fair enough, Mr. Croker.
I hope you'll like Farik and give him the benefit of the doubt. For a kid from the Bluff, he's done pretty well. He's not polished, he's not sophisticated, and he's susceptible to temptation like all of us. But he's been a good kid. Never been in trouble with the law, never been in any kind of disciplinary trouble at Tech. Given the strikes he's had against him, he's done pretty well." To himself, he said, "Jesus Christ, between now and then we gotta put Farik in some kind of courtesy boot camp. We gotta get him some new clothes, out of the Ralph Lauren catalog. We gotta get the diamonds out of his ears, the sneer off his lips, the shanks akimbo spread out of the way he sits in a chair, the homeboy hanging in front of the 24-hour mini-mart slouch out of his posture, the rape, pillage, loot, leer out of his eyes. But something tells me a cosmetic makeover is all we really need. Something tells me the 60-minute man has already taken the hook."
"Oh, hell, I'll give anybody the benefit of the doubt far as that goes," said Croker. "I didn't exactly grow up in any palace myself."
He smiled more broadly than ever, as if to show that he regarded all this as nothing more than a game. Atlanta was not one of those older cities, such as New York, Boston, Seattle, or, for that matter, Paris, London, or Munich, in which the smart restaurants were to be found in the middle of town, or on the fringes of old residential districts. No, in Atlanta, both downtown and midtown, as they were called, shut up tight at 6 p.m. Monday through Friday, and all day Saturday and Sunday, with their soaring towers standing there like glass ghosts. The only strollers on the streets at night downtown
were hotel guests utterly thwarted in their desire to go window shopping at the big city's glossy restaurants and boutiques. Them and the muggers. The Atlanta police had their own name for areas where it wasn't advisable to walk if you looked like you had more than 2 cents to rub together. Dead zones. And downtown was one of them. No, in Atlanta, the smart restaurants, like the smart boutiques, opened in Atlanta's edge cities, as the inimitable Joel Garreau had called them. Commercial clusters that formed in and around shopping malls and other big mixed-use developments, far removed from downtown and its tired old problems. So it was that Peep Gas had decided to take Martha Croker to dinner at a restaurant all the way over at the West Paces Ferry Mall, a place called Mordecai's, which was recommended by all the restaurant guides. This decision had presented Peep Gas with two big problems. For a start, he had to rent a car. At first he thought of having Martha meet him at the restaurant. That way, presumably, she would never have to know which of the cars in this mall full of cars was his. She wouldn't have to learn that he drove a 5-year-old Ford Escort with a big dent in the left front fender, which he couldn't afford to have fixed because his insurance policy had a $500 deductible. But making her drive solo to a shopping mall at night would not create the effect he needed to create. So he started calling the car rental companies, Hertz, Avis, Budget, Alamo, the lot. The only vehicles they offered at even halfway humane rates were as dinky as his Ford Escort, even if newer. If you elevated your sights to the plateau of full-size sedans, you were talking about a fortune and still getting nothing more than a Ford Taurus or a Chevrolet Lumina. So he had to go luxury full-size, an appalling $92 a day for the car he had tonight, a black Volvo 960 with veal beige leather seats. Then there was the restaurant. Mordecai's had just reopened after a complete renovation, and was the restaurant the Social Bees, Le Tou Atlanta, were currently hiving about, to use a term he had picked up the other day from Jack Shelnut, his only live source of information about such matters. And so there was no way he was going to get out of there for less than $80 for two. So you had $172 right there. A guy like Shelnut, of course, would say, "Big deal. $172. But the plain fact was that to Peep Gas it was yet another toehold missing on the face of a cliff that was terrifyingly high, and to which he was already clinging for dear life. He now had 22 different Visa cards, and 19 of them he had already run out to the absolute limit of their credit line. His only hope was that yet more unsolicited Visa card applications would arrive in the mail. He seemed to receive at least 2 a month. And he would have a little more rope to ponzi around with. The problem was that the monthly interest nut all by itself was more than he could handle. He was having to kite checks between Planners Bank, South Bank, Bank Charter, and Banco Hijo Chico, where he also had accounts, in order to keep halfway current on the interest owed the Visa accounts. One Visa card, he noticed, had been issued by a bank called Joshua Tree Federal in Tempe, Arizona. He felt far more at ease, irrationally so, he realized, dealing with Pueblo Desert lunatics like that than with many Delaware banks whose cards he also had. And so this outing, ordinary as it might have seemed to a Jack Shelnut, or to so many of his neighbors to the north of Collier Hills in the real Buckhead, was to Peep Gas a dizzyingly wild leap that only his red dog could have made him do. Attired in his one new shirt, his new sincere necktie, and his one halfway decent suit, the gray one he could get by with as long as he never let her view it from the back, where the shiny spots were, Peep Gas pulled up to Martha Croker's house on Valley Road in his one-night-stand $92-a-day Volvo 960. As soon as he escorted her out to the car, he noticed something different about her. She looked great, given what she had to work with, namely her mileage, 53 years, and the heft she had across her back and shoulders. When she got out of the Volvo at the West Paces Ferry Mall, he tried to study her a little more. There was something so damned gloomy about dinner at these fancy restaurants in the mall. It was so damned dark, since all the shops were closed. The light of the overhead lamps was soaked up by the blacktop of the parking lot, so that nothing more than a pallid gloaming remained. But in this American mall artificial twilight, once he got used to it, Martha Croker looked not bad at all. A white skirt, pretty short, that skirt, for a woman her age. But you know what? Great legs. If all you saw were her legs, you'd think she was 20 or 25 years younger. And inside, when they sat down, at a pretty good table, not too far back, she really looked different, leaner. A long-sleeved navy silk blouse with these sort of flame-like white shapes in it. A choker of ivory ovals framed in gold. Gold earrings. Her blonde hair done just so. He was suddenly conscious of the way he was just sitting there staring at her, and so he smiled and said, "Well, what do you make of this freak Fanon business?" Of the 54 tables at Mordecai's, and the place was packed, at least 45 accommodated white Atlantans who right now were, or just had been, or soon would be, talking about Farik Fanon and what he had or had not done with an anonymous flower of Atlanta's white establishment. Christ, it was noisy in here. All restaurants these days were noisy, but the noise in here was what he imagined, and intended never to find out, what it would be like to go whitewater rafting in some vicious river like the Columbia. Peep Gas had to lean across the table toward Martha to hear what she was saying.
"I don't know what to think," she said. "But I must say it has me curious about who this white business and civic leader might be, the one whose daughter she's supposed to be."
"I'll tell you what I'm curious about," said Peep Gas. "I'm curious about why all these black athletes have such a thing for white women." Martha Croker just lifted her eyebrows and shrugged her shoulders. So Peep Gas figured he ought to get off that street. Talking about black people was a delicate business in upper stratum white Atlanta, particularly if the subject moved onto the terrain of racial tendencies. Even though everybody, Le Tou Atlanta, was wild about the topic, you had to walk a very narrow, very academic, sociological, disinterested line, or else you were guilty of a breach of etiquette. It was sheer bad manners. It showed poor intellectual upbringing. But how could one not talk about the Farik Fanon case? And how easy it was for one's hunger for every morsel about the case to push one over that narrow line. Peep Gas glanced about. So many animated white faces. The whitewater rush of the diners had reached something approaching a roar. In decor, Mordecai's was curiously grand, stiff, gloomy, musty, austere, and ostentatious all at the same time. Like one of those Doge's palaces in Venice, where everything seems to have been soaked in the gray-green water of the canals 5 centuries ago and hung out to dry. Slowly, century by century. As for Martha, she wanted to talk about the Farik Fanon case, too, but Ray's—she already thought of him as Ray's comment had suddenly reminded her of those Saturday nights at Turpentine when Charlie and Billy Bass and Judge Opie McCorkle and the other good old Baker County boys would belt back a few bourbons and branch water and get on the subject of race and lean forward toward each other and mouth the radioactive words in their discourse in the mistaken belief that what they were saying would not be picked up by the black help who went back and forth from the kitchen, and so attentively attended to their every need. She noticed Ray scanning the room with his eyes, and so she looked about, too. Over near the entrance, she noticed Mordecai's owner, a man named Jack Cashy, in a dark double-breasted suit and a very loud tie, hovering over a table for six and bathing it in his famous bonhomie. She, Martha, had walked right past him on the way in, had looked him right in the eye, and his eyes had bounced a couple of times off hers. He knew her, but he didn't know who she was, so he had turned away suddenly, as if responding to someone behind him. She couldn't believe it. She had been at Charlie's side at least a dozen times when they dined here, and the man had fawned over the two of them.
"Mr. Croker, Mrs. Croker."
And now he didn't even have a clue who she was. Well, who was he spending all his time paying attention to tonight? A great big man with carefully coiffed blonde hair. Could it be? That was exactly who it was.
"Ray," she exclaimed, "you'll never guess who's here tonight."
"Who?"
"Don't turn around all of a sudden, but right behind you, about four tables away, up near the entrance, a table for six. That's Buck McNutter. Buck McNutter and his wife."
Ray slowly turned about, then glanced back at Martha.
"Which one is him?"
"The immense one with the cute blonde hairdo."
Ray took a good look, then turned back around.
"I'll be damned. I wouldn't mind listening in on that conversation. You know him?"
"I've never met him, but I met his wife once."
Ray said, "Which one's the wife?"
"The youngest one," said Martha, "with the hair."
Ray turned around again and took another good look. Then he turned back with a grin and said,
"I see what you mean. You think if we sent them a bottle of champagne, they'd tell us the name of the girl in the Fannin case?"
A terribly severe-looking waiter, or captain, he probably was, arrived and asked if they'd like something to drink. Martha asked for a Cure Royale, which Peepgas had never heard of. All he knew was that it sounded expensive. He ordered a glass of red wine, figuring that would be the cheapest thing in the house short of a split of sparkling water. Mordecai's was the sort of restaurant in which, when you sit down, there's an elaborate silver plate sitting right in front of you. As soon as they bring you a drink, they take it away. Peepgas had no idea what that was all about, but to him it, too, spelled expensive. In due course, the dour-looking captain returned. He had to be a captain. Returned with menus, very formal menus, which arrived inserted into stiff leather bindings. The oppressive atmosphere of expense weighed even more heavily upon Peepgas. With dread, he took a glance at the entrees. All over $20. He didn't kid himself. In a place like this, when the entrees were more than $20, you knew you were heading up toward not a mere $80 for two, but more like $100. Martha ordered smoked salmon on rectangles of ciabatta bread to start. Peepgas winced. $8.50. And blackened red snapper on a bed of kale leaves and dilled mashed potatoes. Winced again. $26.50. Jesus Christ, no wonder she was hefty through the torso. He ordered the cheapest first course he could get away with, which was tortellini al brodo, some kind of soup, apparently, for $5.50, and a pasta as his main course. Risotto with sectioned baby octopus, $18.50. But he knew he couldn't down the goddamned risotto and octopus without a bottle of nice cold wine to take the edge off it. And so he suddenly found himself ordering a bottle of Rusher's Quarry California Chardonnay for $36, which blew all his economizing right out of the water. His facile mind, which had scored 780 out of a possible 800 on the math SATs, realized immediately that they had now ordered $95 worth of food and drink, plus the Cure Royale and the glass of red wine, which would certainly bring it up over $100,
and they hadn't even gotten to dessert and coffee and the tax. But, now what the hell? Thank God he had a brand new Visa card with him, from some bank called First Butte in Mission Creek, Colorado. He knocked back 2 glasses of the Rusher's Quarry California Chardonnay, and she knocked back 1, all so fast that he could foresee the necessity of ordering a 2nd bottle in no time, at which point he decided to give up and maintain an even strain and let First Butte eat the bill. They talked a little more about the Farik Fannin case, which in turn got them to talking about how absolutely sports-crazed Atlanta was. And Martha told him about some Neanderthal judge down in Baker County who had sat on the 50-yard line for every Georgia Tech, University of Georgia football game for the past 50 years, she was sure. And he asked her if Charlie had been hung up on his memories of gridiron greatness. Not really, she said, but other people were. Total strangers, older people mostly, still recognized him on the street and referred to him as the 60-minute man. And Charlie did enjoy that. Peepgas had to lean farther and farther across the table, to within a foot of her face, just to hear her over the din of the place. "Speaking of Charlie," said Peepgas. He figured that was a smooth enough transition to what, for him, was the underlying agenda for this back-breakingly expensive evening. "I have some interesting news about Croker Concourse."
"Really?"
She didn't seem terribly keen about any protracted discussion of her former husband. Peepgas leaned forward and said, "Charlie is about to hand over Croker Concourse and the other properties, and we'll let him keep Turpentine and his house on Blackland Road and the Wyeth painting."
"What's he going to use for money? Do you have any idea what it costs to run Turpentine?"
"Not exactly."
"Close to $2 million a year."
"He has it on the books as an experimental farm," said Peepgas.
"I don't doubt that," said Martha. "But the only experiment I've ever seen at Turpentine is Charlie trying to see if he can go through a whole day of shooting quail from dawn to dusk and shoot only the males."
"How do you tell the male from the female?"
"It's not easy. The male has a little fleck of white on his neck." She touched the front of her own neck.
Peepgas said, "I bet he's rolled every cent he's spent on the place right into his corporate tax deductions."
"Probably," said Martha.
Peepgas experienced the aha phenomenon. If necessary, he'd confront Croker with an income tax problem. The IRS would no doubt be delighted to learn that he had written off millions, millions, in personal expenses in the form of a non-existent experimental farm. "Anyway," said Peepgas, "there's been an interesting development regarding Croker Concourse. This I'm not supposed to be telling anybody either, but I think you have a legitimate right to know. I guess the word has gotten out that Croker Concourse may be up for sale, because a syndicate is being formed to approach the bank with an offer."
"A syndicate?"
"A group of investors," said Peepgas. "The leading figures. But this really does have to remain confidential." He looked at her inquiringly.
"All right."
"The leading figures, the people putting the whole thing together, are Herbert Richman and Julius Licht."
"Both Jews," thought Martha,
without even knowing why it occurred to her. She started to say so out loud, but caught herself and thought better of it. What she said was,
"I go to one of his gyms, Herbert Richman's Definition America, on East Paces Ferry Road."
"Do you know Herb Richman?" said Peepgas.
"No, I don't think I've ever met him," said Martha.
She started to add,
"He's Jewish, isn't he?"
But once again she caught herself. All this took place beneath the threshold of rational thought, in much the same way that Herbert Richman, if someone had mentioned the name Martha Croker, would have said to himself,
"She's not Jewish."
Such was the way things still went in Atlanta.
"Well, he's met Charlie," said Peepgas, "just a couple of weeks ago. You know Herb's Jewish, don't you?"
I suppose... No, I didn't.
As if the thought had never crossed her mind. Charlie invited him down for a weekend at Turpentine.
Is that how Richmond found out that Croker Concourse might be for sale, from Charlie?
I don't know, said Peepgas, but I doubt it. I don't think Charlie has fully faced up yet to the fact that he's going to lose a lot of property. Anyway, here's what Herb Richmond and his syndicate would do. And again, I'm really not supposed to be telling anybody about this, but I think it's something you might want to know. He proceeded to outline the deal, leaving out only the matter of the $6.5 million he stood to make from it.
Now, I don't know anything about your financial situation beyond Charlie's obligations to you under the terms of the divorce agreement, but you might want to consider getting in on this.
Me?
I think you ought to ask yourself where it leaves you if Charlie is to all intents and purposes dead broke. Martha didn't say anything. She just looked at him. Suddenly she was acutely aware of the ecstatic hyperburble of all the voices in this week's Restaurant of the Century. The fact was, she couldn't even imagine her own financial situation if there was no check for $50,000 each month. That had always been the least of her concerns about Charlie. What was that compared to the fact that he had deceived and discarded her? Exactly, nothing more or less than that. Discarded her as a superannuated piece of baggage.
Look at it this way, said Ray. The reason Charlie's going broke is that he totally lost his head over this building of his, this great monument to himself, Croker Concourse. Do you realize that no other developer in the history of Atlanta has ever named a building after himself before?
Martha started to tell him exactly why Charlie had suffered such an inflation of himself. He had just started his affair with Serena, and wanted to show her that despite his age, he had the confidence and puissance of youth. But she was loath to let Ray know just how profoundly humiliated she had been. So all she said was,
"Oh, I know. When Charlie loses his head over something, he loses it all the way."
Ray said, "What I'm suggesting is, and it may not interest you at all, but what I'm suggesting is that if Charlie has created a situation in which he can't come through with what he owes you, in cash, you have the right to follow his money where it's disappeared to, namely, into that building." Martha's first reaction had nothing to do with the content of what he had just said. Rather, it was that she liked him more this way. He now seemed more of a man. He was no Charlie, but he had Charlie's passion for the deal, which was perhaps where the contemporary male's passion for battle went these days. She studied his face as his lips moved. He was actually a good-looking man, and his passion for the deal put an edge on the softness that you initially detected in a man like this. His clothes were a mixture of the slightly seedy and the slightly gaudy. But this was a period in which men's clothes were pretty dreadful all the way around. Charlie hadn't been much of a dresser either, but his sheer massive physical presence had made that not matter. Peepgas could see Martha Croker studying his face, and it made him apprehensive. Was she merely confused, or did she fear a trick, some sort of swindle? Maybe she was thinking, "If I'm going to be cut off from Charlie's money, why should I throw a lot of what I have left into some speculative real estate deal?" So he said, "Look, I can't engrave anything in stone, but here's a chance to triple or quadruple an investment in 2 to 3 years, and it would be taxed as a long-term capital gain. Richmond and Licht are ready to invest $2.5 million each, and they're not speculators. As businessmen, they're both conservative. Richmond won't even take Definition America public for fear of losing control. And do you have any idea of what that company would be worth as an IPO?
"Wow,"
he added, by way of emphasizing the sheer visceral impact of such an idea.
"Well, I couldn't begin to put up $2.5 million, Martha Croker said.
"No one would expect you to, said Peepgas.
They're putting up approximately half the down payment themselves, and they're looking for other investors to put up the rest. I'm sure it wouldn't make any difference to them how big a share you went in for. And I..." He hesitated and turned his eyes downward, then turned them up again, as if this ocular pitch and roll were a product of emotion. "Well, frankly, I don't mean to say anything out of line, but I think it would be poetic justice, and no more than you deserve, if Charlie had to give up the building entirely. And believe me, that he's going to have to do. And you became one of the owners." He looked at her with sincerity engraved upon his face. To Martha, the scheme, the investment, the odds, the risks, were remote matters she would have to think about later. What she comprehended at this moment was that here was a man who seemed to care about her fate.
"I don't know," she said. "I'd have to think about it. I'd have to think about how much I could possibly commit to something like that."
It struck Peepgas that she said it sort of dreamily. What that could mean, he couldn't imagine. Well, she didn't say no. She held it out as a possibility. Suppose she put up 1 million. His facile head for figures ran it through the intracranial chemical analog computer in no time. She'd come away with $7 million, not counting the commissions. He'd have 6.5 million. Add them together, along with Martha's other 9 million, and you've got $22 million. Invest it conservatively, at 6%, and you'd have $1.3 million per year in income, plus a house in the very best part of Buckhead already paid for and decorated to the hilt. You could live a damned good life in Atlanta. A damned good life anywhere. Peepgas, what are you thinking? The woman's 53 years old, for Christ's sake. What about Priapus? Doesn't he have any say in all this? Peepgas was suddenly aware that a couple, a man and a woman, who were heading toward the entrance, had stopped by their table. He looked up. Both were beaming down at Martha. Lots of teeth. The woman, close to 50, a carefully coiffed helmet of pineapple blonde hair, slender, nice angular features, handsome as opposed to beautiful, which she once must have been, expensive-looking cream tweed jacket and skirt, about 500 watts of jewelry. The man, slightly older, a big rectangular face resting upon a set of buttery jowls, good head of silvery hair combed straight back, not one cilium out of place, as if he'd just emerged from the locker room of the Augusta Country Club. Navy cashmere blazer and a striped tie lying as if they lived there on the heft of his sirloin midsection. Lots of teeth.
"Martha!" said the woman, shrieking to be heard above the roar of the rapids.
"Why, Adele!" said Martha Croker. "And Jock!"
"I thought that was you I saw across the room," said Adele. "I feel like I haven't seen you in ages."
Then she glanced toward Peepgas.
"Adele," said Martha Croker, "I'd like for you to meet Ray Peepgas. Ray, Adele Gilchrist, and Jock Gilchrist."
Peepgas struggled to his feet, while Adele Gilchrist made protestations to the effect that he shouldn't get up. He put on a big smile and shook hands with both of them. A hearty, deep-voiced Jock Gilchrist began compressing Peepgas's knuckles in a manly handshake. Meantime, Adele was shrieking to Martha Croker,
"Have you been here before?"
"No. Have you?"
"Once," said Adele. "It's too noisy. But I love the food."
"Please sit down, Ray. I didn't mean for you."
"Oh, not at all," said Peepgas. "Jock, we've got to let these people finish their dinner. But anyway, it's so nice to see you, Martha. You must give me a call. Ray, it's so nice to meet you. Have fun."
As the pair made their way toward the front, Martha Croker began laughing soundlessly. This made Peepgas smile. "What's funny?"
"Oh, nothing," said Martha Croker. "I was just thinking of the last time I saw Adele Gilchrist. It's not very interesting, and it would take too long to go into."
That's not Gilchrist of Kerry Gilchrist, is it?
Yes, it is. That's Jock.
Peep Gas whistled to himself. Kerry Gilchrist was one of the biggest investment banking firms in the South. Martha began chuckling to herself again. Peep Gas started to ask her why again, but he figured she would tell him if she wanted to. So he just stared at her quizzically. Martha was tempted to tell him. 2 weeks ago, at Definition America, she and Adele had been in Mustafa Gunt's class, and Adele had cut her dead. No, cut indicated an act of volition, and this had not been a cruel and willful act. The truth was that she had ceased to even see her, as if socially she, Martha, had disintegrated and no longer existed, all because she was no longer attached to the great Charlie Croker. But now that she had popped up in this week's Restaurant of the Century with a rather good-looking man, she had become resubstantiated, if there was such a word, was once again corporeal, a woman whose life suddenly stimulated curiosity in the likes of Adele Gilchrist, who no doubt wanted to ascertain just who it was that the long-since-vanished and long-since-vanquished Martha Croker was out on the town with. Oh, she was tempted to tell Ray. But if she cared to see more of Mr. Raymond Peep Gas, and she realized that indeed she did, it would be far wiser not to reveal the depths of her humiliations. Still chuckling silently, she said to Ray,
"I'm sorry, it's just that Adele's so two-faced. But it's too petty to go into."
Peep Gas couldn't have cared less about Adele Gilchrist's two faces. Martha was on a first-name basis with people like Jock Gilchrist. She not only had a mansion on Valley Road, she could take a man immediately, socially, into the upper strata of Atlanta. In an era like this one, the 20th century's fin de siècle, position was everything, and it was the hardest thing to get. Once you had position, there were innumerable places to go for life's merely carnal delights. Chapter 24 Gridiron Heroes. Habersham Road. Habersham Road. It was only a stone's throw from his old house on Valley Road, where Martha still lived, but that was only a fleeting thought. Much more on Charlie's mind was the fact that it was less than a quarter of a mile from Inman's house on Tuxedo Road. A stab of guilt, one among many he had endured since promising to go to Buck McNutter's house to meet Farik Fannin. He was slowly tooling along Habersham in his Cadillac, not in any hurry for this rendezvous, thankful that it was now almost dark by 8:30 p.m. He didn't want to have to think of any nosy souls peering out the windows of any of the palatial piles in this golden swath of Buckhead, just off West Paces Ferry Road, saying, "There goes Charlie Croker to Buck McNutter's house. I wonder why." He realized that was paranoid of him, and he was not the paranoid type. But that was what betrayal did to you. It made you run untrue to form. "No," he kept telling himself, "I'm not betraying Inman by just going to meet this clown. I haven't committed myself to any particular course of action. I may even find out something that will help Inman." But in his heart he knew the plain truth. He was tempted. He flicked on the Cadillac's high beams, the better to see the house numbers, which were always on or near the mailboxes at the foot of the evergreen, ever-groomed lawns. There it was. Dogwood, magnolias, chestnut trees, and Japanese maples adorned the lawn in such profusion, he couldn't see the house at first. But as the Cadillac ascended the steep, curving asphalt driveway and came closer, he could scarcely believe it. Langhorne Epps's old house. Lang Epps, who had inherited a fortune in Southern Railway stock and been president of the Piedmont Driving Club and the chairman of every charity drive you could think of,
possessor of the oldest money you could find in Atlanta, no two ways about it. That was his old house, built in the French chateau style. All those casement windows. And now the Georgia Tech football coach had it. He, Charlie, loved the game of football, but Jesus Christ! The world was changing too fast. A wave of self-loathing. He himself was changing too fast. Inman. But he hadn't been disloyal to Inman in any way. He couldn't control the future. But he could control his own conduct. He stopped thinking about it, pushed it out of his mind. McNutter had quite a border of liriope around the loop of asphalt in front of the house. Charlie pulled up behind a silver-gray four-door Lexus sedan. A $65,000 car. He wondered whose it was. McNutter's? Lawyer White's? Tariq Fannin's? Given the cockeyed nature of everything these days, it just might be Fannin's.
Laboriously he got out of the car, wincing from the pain of his right knee as he tried to steady it beneath his 235 pounds, and went limping over to the door, wondering how much of the pain was psychological, how much of it shot down to his knee from his guilt-riddled brain. He rang the doorbell, and in less than 10 seconds the door opened, and there stood a startling vision. A young woman with a head of blonde hair, as full and meticulously untamed as Serena's, a long-sleeved chiffon silk blouse with sprays of many colors against a deep purple background, open at the throat and plunging down to a deep cleavage.
"Mr. Croker!"
She lowered her head, so that her eyes had to open a mile wide to look into his, and gave him a sly smile that promised the devil knew what.
"Come in. I'm Val McNutter."
She put out her hand, and he shook it.
"There and there," she said, motioning to a doorway off to one side. "But first I have to tell you something."
She paused, and her big insinuating eyes compelled him to ask what. "What's that?"
"I had lunch at your Cosmos Club the other day, and I absolutely adored it. I could have stayed there all afternoon."
"Well," said Charlie, "I'm glad to hear that. But I'm afraid that puts you in the minority."
She looked at him as if his very words were an aphrodisiac. If he hadn't been in such a depressed frame of mind, he would have felt a bit of the old tingle. Then she said,
"May I get you something to drink?"
Charlie's throat was terribly dry, which he realized was a sign of nervousness. In his depressed state, alcohol helped at first, but after an hour or so only depressed him more. But he decided he needed help right now. The short-term gain or the long-term loss? The hell with the long-term. He wasn't even sure he would last that long. He wanted help now.
"Well," he said as offhandedly as he could, "wouldn't mind a tall scotch and soda if I didn't too much trouble."
"Not at all. Come on in here and I'll go get it for you."
She led him to the doorway of a room off the hall, stuck her head inside, and said,
"Buck, Mr. Croker's here."
The doorway was suddenly filled with the huge familiar figure of Buck McNutter. Familiar not because Charlie had once met him, literally just that, met him, shook hands and exchanged a couple of pleasantries at a Tech reunion, but because he had so often seen the man's smooth bulk and curiously fussy silver-blonde hairdo on television and in the newspapers. The big man flashed him a grin and exclaimed, "Hey, Charlie!" as if that one meeting had made them lifelong but long-time no-see friends, and thrust out his hand and gave him a handshake that made him think his knuckles were being crushed. Two could play that game. Charlie squeezed back, using all the strength of his muscles. The two men stood there, an exquisitely balanced picture of giants in pain. McNutter unclenched first and said,
"Great to see you, Charlie. Come on in here and meet some folks."
The room was paneled in so much heavy, ornate dark wood it seemed to absorb every lumen of available light. It was a second or two before he fully took in the forms of the other two men. One, on his feet and smiling cordially,
was lawyer Roger White, once again decked out like an ambassador on an official visit. The other was a much younger, much darker black man with a shaved head, who sat sprawled on a tufted leather couch. McNutter turned toward him and glowered, and the young man slowly rose, as if weighed down by the weariness of the ages, and stared at a point beyond Charlie and McNutter, as if his only interest in this weary world lay far removed from the walls of Chateau McNutter and the rolling green lawns of Buckhead. "Charlie," McNutter was saying, "I believe you know Roger White." So Charlie and Lawyer White shook hands and smiled cordially. "And, Charlie, this is Farik Fannin. Farik, Charlie Croker." As he extended his hand, Charlie gave this now-notorious All-American a once-over. The ears. He had been told that the cannon had pierced ears with a diamond set in each lobe and wore a heavy gold necklace. But there was no jewelry at all. He was slightly taller than Charlie, and had very wide shoulders, made even wider by the suit he was wearing. A dark blue double-breasted suit with the lapel rolled down to the bottom button. It looked to Charlie like a felony suit, the sort of dark blue suit defense lawyers put on their clients when they go to trial. He wore a white shirt whose collar looked as if it had never been properly introduced to the big, powerful neck it had been buttoned around, and a necktie with wavy, navy, and gray stripes running vertically. He was giving Charlie a wary look typical of his generation, white, black, or whatever else, the felony hangdog. You tuck your chin down toward your clavicle, turn your head 15 or 20 degrees to the side, and look warily at the adult confronting you, as if you've just committed a felony. You also offer only your first name during the introduction, as if you might be a drug dealer. Gloriously bored, Farik Fannin presented Charlie a limp hand. "Hey, Farik," said Charlie, "nice to meet you. How you doing?" His head still in the hangdog, Farik the Cannon Fannin didn't offer so much as a polite smile. He merely compressed his lips and nodded. He had everything but a sign around his neck reading, "Don't wanna." "Have a seat, Charlie," said McNutter, in a voice about 20% cheerier than necessary, indicating an easy chair that had been pulled up near one end of the couch. Roger White sat down in the chair at the other end, and McNutter sat in a chair facing the young athlete. Still beaming, McNutter looked at Charlie and said, "I was just telling Farik how they used to call you the 60-minute man. How did that happen? I mean, you playing the whole game, defense and offense." Farik broke in. "That's the truth? That's what they called you, the 60-minute man?" Farik had a big grin on. At first, Roger took this as a sign he was warming to the task. "Well, you know how the newspapers dream these things up," said that model of modesty, Charlie Croker. "Huh," said Farik with a dismissive chortle, while his smile turned into a sneer. "Then you be the one that song's about." "What song?" said Charlie. "The 60-minute man," said Farik. He began to hum it. "Hoo-ha, hoo-hum-ha, hey, 60-minute man." "What's it about?" said McNutter, who now had a desperate smile on his face. "It's about this dude can keep a bitch happy for 60 minutes without stopping. Hoo-ha, hoo-hum-ha, hey, 60-minute man." More sneering and grinning. "Is that what they meant?" Long silence. McNutter turned back to Charlie and said, "What was it like playing 60 minutes of Division I football, or what we'd call Division I today?"
"Hoo-ha, hoo-hum-ha, hey, 60-minute man,"
Farik sang softly, as if to himself. "Oh, I wasn't the only one," said Charlie, looking toward McNutter. "It was kind of a transition period between the old rules, when if you left the game you couldn't come back in until the next quarter, and the new rules with platooning."
Taking a chance and looking toward Fannin with a Charlie Croker winning smile, he said, "It helped to be a little crazy. I mean, wanting to butt heads for the whole 60 minutes if you didn't have to." His gaze intersected with Fannin's only up to the word little. At that point, the black youth's eyes strayed off into the distance. No smile at all. Not even a sneering one. So Charlie turned back toward McNutter as he said, "For a little while, there were even guys in the NFL and the AFL. Remember the AFL? Guys who did the same thing. I think the last one was Chuck Bednarik. Used to play for the Philadelphia Eagles." McNutter gave him a smile that indicated he found that the most fascinating piece of information that had come his way in a long time. But his eyes betrayed a state of panic. He turned toward Fannin, his face seemingly wreathed in merriment, and said, "How'd you like to play defense and offense, Farik?" Then to Charlie, "You played linebacker on defense, isn't that right?"
"Hum-ha-hey,"
sang Farik, mocked softly. Charlie nodded yes. McNutter tried out the question on Fannin once more. "How'd you like that? I could arrange it." As if this were the merriest conversation in years. Fannin lowered his head, cast his eyes downward, expelled a big snort of air through his nose, looked up with a gaze that shot halfway between McNutter and Lawyer White, and said,
"I don't know. Never thought about it."
McNutter was speechless for a moment. Then he began twisting a huge ring on his left hand. A college ring, a Super Bowl ring, whatever it was, with his right hand. Then he said to Charlie, "I was trying to explain to Farik and Roger here about that thing you were famous for in that game with the Bulldogs, the time you were playing defense and took the ball from their quarterback, but I didn't know any of the details."
"Oh, it was mostly luck," said Charlie. "We were down by 6 points with about 40 seconds in the game, and the Bulldogs had the ball on their own 25. So all they had to do was eat up the clock with runs up the middle, and they had the ball game."
"Y'all had just kicked off to 'em, right?"
"Yeah."
"Because you'd just broken loose on a 48-yard touchdown run, right?"
McNutter looked toward Fannin as he uttered the last part of the sentence, frantically hoping he had ignited at least a show of interest in his 20-year-old All-American. But Fannin remained regally removed from the sphere of conversation.
"Hoo-ha, hoo-hum-ha-hee, 60-minute man.
Now McNutter looked frantically toward Charlie.
"So how'd it happen?"
"Well," said Charlie, "they had a quarterback named Rufus Smiley. He was a smart quarterback, but sometimes he got a little too smart."
Charlie looked toward Farik Fannin to see if this story was as yet engaging him. The canon looked as if he had just departed the room via astral projection. So Charlie turned back toward McNutter. On first down, he handed off to this big fullback they had, Rudy Brower, and he ran right up the middle. On second down, he did the same thing. By now he's eaten up 20 seconds, and there's only 20 seconds left on the clock. So I figured we gotta make something happen. That's the only chance we had. So I decided to blitz, right between center and guard, hoping for a fumble. Well, this was when Smiley got a little too cute. This time, on third down, to eat up more time, he fakes a handoff to their wing back, who's in motion between Smiley and Rudy Brower. Charlie looked at Fannin again. No one there. So then he looked at Lawyer Roger White. The man at least pretended to be engrossed. So Charlie kept looking at him, meantime maintaining a vigil out of the corner of his eye for the attention of Farik the Canon Fannin. "So I'm blitzing between center and guard, hoping to dislodge the ball from Smiley or Brower, and I get there, and I can't believe it." Charlie faked as much animation as he could with this yarn, hoping against hope to draw the mighty Fannin back into the conversational orbit. "Smiley's still holding the ball out like this." He pantomimed a quarterback holding the ball out for a handoff, to hand it off to Brower after the fake to the wingback. "So instead of going for Smiley, I went for the ball.
and I know this is hard to believe, but I took it just the way I would have if I'd have been on offense. It was a handoff, a wrong-way handoff.
He was still looking at Farik's lawyer, Roger White, who was smiling and nodding encouragingly. Farik Fannin, meantime, had the look on his face that you get when you're in line at a pay telephone kiosk, and the fellow on the telephone just won't get off. Charlie plowed on.
A split second later, here comes Brower charging forward to take the handoff, and bam! I smack right into him. Like I say, he was a big son of a bitch. But I had the momentum, because I'd blitzed from all the way behind the line of scrimmage, and he got knocked right on his back. There was nobody between me and the goal line. And so I scored, and we got the extra point and won the game 14-13. I'm telling you, I couldn't hardly believe it myself. If Smiley hadn't have fooled around with that fake to the wingback, we'd have lost that game.
With a big smile, Charlie surveyed his audience. Roger White, smiling, shook his head with the shake that says, "Wow, that's amazing." Coach Buck McNutter was smiling and nodding, not at Charlie, but at Farik, as if he thought his big head might create some psychokinetic vibrations and cause his shaved-pate young All-American to smile and nod with him. As for Fannin himself, well, at least he was looking at Charlie for a change. He wasn't smiling, he wasn't nodding, he wasn't showing any particular reaction to this bit of tech sports lore as related by